Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music. We've just heard the waltzes from Der Rosenkavalier by Richard Strauss, performed by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Lauren Mazel. This is their first release on the Deutsche Grammophon DG Concert Series, which is available in the form of internet downloads as well as on CD. Maestro Mazel has conducted more than 150 orchestras in no fewer than 5,000 opera and concert performances, has made over 300 recordings of varied repertoire, performed as a violin soloist with some of the world's greatest orchestras, has written solos and concerti for various instruments, and a highly acclaimed opera. He is committed to humanitarian and environmental causes, speaks at least six languages fluently, has been honored with national awards and decorations from Italy, France, Finland, and UNESCO, amongst others, and appears today on Crossover as our guest. Welcome to Crossover, and thank you so much for finding time for us here at WRTI.
My pleasure.
What can I say? Your credentials are incredible. We don't even have time to go through them all. You are so very, very well known and so beloved, I believe, throughout the whole world. And this tour that you're on now is, I hate to say final tour, but you will not be doing them anymore. So how does that feel?
Yeah, well, this is, in fact, my seventh and last season with the New York Philharmonic. But it had been stated right from the beginning that I didn't wish to stay longer than 7 years. Seven is a number I like very much, and so did one of my predecessors, Arturo Toscanini, who was busy director of 7 years of the orchestra for 7 years, and felt also that that would be just the right amount of time. I certainly am going to miss the Philharmonic because we've grown very fond of one another musically and humanly, and it's just a good, healthy scene. A fabulous orchestra, and they're playing just superbly well, and we make marvelous music together, and indeed, I will certainly miss them, but I think it's very important for a new music director to have time and space, not be reminded of the presence of his predecessor in the wings, so to speak. So I'm giving Maestro Gilbert a couple of years breathing space, and then I'll come back as a guest, and we'll smile benevolently and be happy to work again with the orchestra. But leaving New York, of course, will give me the opportunity of going back to my old friends, the Vienna Philharmonic, of which I'm an honorary member and have been for several years, and I just haven't had time to make music with them. And we're going off on some very, very major international tours in 2009 and especially 2010. And then the Philharmonia in London, which I conducted for the first time over a half a century ago.
And, what a wonderful orchestra that is.
It's a fantastic orchestra, and I'll be doing a lot of music with them, too. But, of course, I'm also going to have time to compose. I'm also leaving my position as music director of the Palau Theater in Valencia, Spain, because, again, you know, having auditioned the orchestra and having been with him for three seasons and introduced some 12, 13 titles into the repertoire, I feel that I've done my bit to get them started. And I need time for myself, if only to try to better service all the requests that we're getting to do 1984 about the world. So, you know, it's...
That's your opera.
It's my opera, yes. Right? I'm just going to be kind of busy, but I will certainly never forget the New York Philharmonic. I hold them in great affection, esteem, and admire them individually and collectively enormously.
Well, you, there's so much that you, so much talent that you have. You were a child prodigy as a conductor, I suppose. What? How old were you when you first conducted? 9?
Yeah, something like that.
Yes. And, of course, a violinist. Accomplished as well. You performed as a soloist and so on, and of course a conductor and a composer. From The Soldier's Tale, L'Histoire du Soldat by Igor Stravinsky, we heard Ragtime, Lauren Mazel violin, Heinrich Braun double bass, Karl-Heinz Steffens clarinet, Eberhard Marshall bassoon, Wolfgang Bauer trumpet, Hans-Jörg Profanter trombone, and Marcus Steckler percussion. The subject matter, 1984, is rather depressing. I was wondering how did you arrive at that as the plot for your opera?
Well, I was commissioned to write an opera, not necessarily 1984, and in discussing the subject matter, a possible title with the then general manager of the residence, Prince Regent Theater in Munich, Germany, Professor Everding, who was the person who commissioned me to write the opera, we spent a good 6 months tracking down various titles and sorting out various options, and finally decided that what we wanted to do is present perhaps the most important novel of the 20th century in operatic form. So we settled on 1984, and I happen to feel that the message is very relevant.
Yes, unfortunately.
And unfortunately, and because the danger has not gone away.
No.
1984, it's true, came and went, but he picked this number out of the sky.
Well, of course, it was very, very far in the future when he wrote it, so...
Well, he wrote it in 1948, and yeah. It was simply, he just turned the numbers around.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Is that what he did?
Yeah, and so it became 1984. Mm-hmm. But he was thinking about a future situation, and the danger is still there. And a lot of young people seem to understand that because wherever I give the opera, I've got sold-out houses, and I would think that 90% of the people listening are under 35.
Now, is the music of a contemporary vein? I mean, is that your...
Well, I am of this age.
Yes.
And write music, I think, that is extremely contemporary in idiom and feeling. But I'm also writing or wrote an opera in the grand tradition of opera with duets and trios and,
yes,
and arias and whatever. There's a lot of 12-tone music, a lot of 8-tonal music, and a lot of tonal music. And, depending on what the situation is, if you're in a nightclub, then you hear blues. And if you hear a washerwoman singing, well, she sings the kind of song that a washerwoman would sing in the 50s, 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's love music, well, it's music that you can remember and believe it's love music. But if we're talking about the torture scenes or the hate chorus, well, that's an entirely different musical language and very tough, and I evocative it is.
When did you start composing?
The opera?
No.
Oh, I was trained as a composer as a child. I had a very strict harmony and counterpoint teacher, and I had to write a fugue every day for a year. I have a little notebook with over 300 fugues. So, I earned it.
But you actually were, I would say, three-pronged as a musician. You were, you were a violinist, an instrumentalist, you are a composer, and of course, renowned as a conductor. So it's really quite overwhelming in terms of the fact that all of these things demand an enormous amount of time and dedication, and yet you have managed to do all of them.
Well, I have. I'm a fairly well-organized person when it comes to dividing up the day, what time goes to what, and how much effort I give to each one of my interests. But I have certainly not tried to spread myself too thin. I'm not a workaholic, and I've taken four sabbaticals in my life and managed to find time to play tennis.
Yes,
be with my family. And
yes,
so
of course, yes. But it is very, very unusual. It's interesting that to be good at many things like that, there are people throughout the history of music that have done it, but congratulations to you. And of course, you are still maintaining your energy at a very high level.
Lauren Mazel was music director of the Cleveland Symphony between 1972 and 1982. We listen now to a recording that was made in 1972 for the Cleveland Orchestra Radio Network. It's the second movement of the Manfred Symphony, which is four pictures by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky. This is The Witch of the Alps with Lauren Mazel conducting the Cleveland Orchestra. We've just heard the second movement of the Manfred Symphony by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky, The Witch of the Alps, performed by the Cleveland Orchestra, with Lauren Mazel conducting. Maestro Mazel is our guest today here on Crossover. Mazel eventually made studio recordings of Tchaikovsky symphonies numbers 4, 5, and 6 with the Cleveland Orchestra. This particular recording was done in a live concert at Severance Hall on November 30th in 1972. Can you tell me, what do you think the future is of orchestras? This is a real problem we're talking about now of support. This is nothing new, however, but it has gotten very, very serious. Have you any views on that subject?
Well, I think what we need to do is bring more and more people into the loop. That is, young people. I think it's scandalous that we're not teaching classical music in schools, that there aren't more choruses. Young people need to sing, and we need a public. The more people out there demanding great music magnificently performed, the more money there is to support an activity of that nature. And so we need to do what they're doing in China or Japan. We were just to China, touring in Hong Kong and Shanghai and
yes.
Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
We had packed houses, and we had a lot of people on the stage too. And I looked around, and I couldn't find anybody over 30. I mean, it's the young people interested in classical music.
Well, it's a brave new world, I guess.
World, and everybody's cheering and loving it and enthusiastic. And so that's no reason why we can't do the same thing in the States.
Well, is there a solution? I mean, obviously there's a problem. It's permeated all of the music scene, and everyone is talking about it. Everyone who is involved in music is talking about it. And
some of it is due to the fact that classical music is performed in such a doctrinaire and pedantic and scholastic and lifeless fashion. Music has to be brought to life. There have to be great performers, and there are fewer and fewer truly great conductors. I come from a generation.
Yes, you do.
Mm-hmm. Not my generation, the one older.
Right.
Where they were, 25, 30 truly great conductors. And you just don't find them today. And
what do you think is the reason for that?
One of the reasons why I'm finally decided to run some master classes at my festival in Castleton, Virginia, which I just announced. You may have read about
it. Yes.
I'm going to find their true conducting talent and try to train them and put them on their way, and gradually, and fill the stages, perhaps, with truly motivated, passionate young people who care about classical music and now know how to make it happen.
But again, I wonder why is there such a dearth of new talent? And I mean, have to start somewhere, ago.
There's no absence, no dearth of young instrumental talent or vocal talent.
But I mean conductors, certainly
conductors,
years ago.
Well, because of this odd campaign against the so-called dictator and the star and so forth. I mean,
authority, I guess it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of pseudo-democratization of our profession. It's, of course, it's nonsense. Some people lead, some people follow. Some people are born to lead and some are born to follow. So some of the best leaders have been followers. In fact, that's the best training there is.
Right.
But eventually, when you get there, having been through the mill, you know what it's about, and then you lead. And then your leadership qualities should be praised and lauded and not ripped apart by those who are basically envious and have their own agendas and want to put down anybody who shows any individuality, any talent, any passion, any thrust, what used to be called personality.
Well, I think also, though, our society does not respect authority at all. And I think you see that in young people. But I somehow think that musicians are disciplined, and they certainly do. They go through the gamut. I mean, it's not as though they're not.
But the musicians are only too grateful to have a true leader on the podium, and so are the audiences. Only too grateful if somebody walks to that podium and starts to make music come alive. They all look at one another and say, you can see them saying, finally, it's happened. we hear a real concert. And if we were to read about it in the press, a true reflection of the excitement that's engendered by a performance full of life and passion and a throbbing enthusiasm for the material, well, it would be very helpful. But I've seen so many young people go out there and perform magnificently with their own feeling for phrasing and just torn to shreds by the press, rather than being lauded and supported. So young people are very afraid, even these marvelous instrumentalists, because after all they have to pay the rent, they're afraid to go out and really make it happen. And it's, the kind of politically correct playing, which in the end will in fact destroy classical music. So I'm going to do what I can to encourage young people to do their thing and let the chips fall where they may.
Thank you.
Music from the Rosenkavalier Suite of Richard Strauss, performed by the New York Philharmonic, with Lauren Mazel conducting. Maestro Mazel is our guest today here on Crossover. How is the United States? I mean, you came from Korea, North Korea, and of course, that must have been quite an exciting experience. How is the United States viewed abroad generally? I mean, you've been to Europe and you've been to Asia.
Well,
in terms of music, once again, let's
well,
stick
if we're talking
to
about
music.
Classical music, I think we're very well represented. We could be very happy, very proud of Americans who go abroad and defend classical music and the American tradition of making classical music. It compensates a great deal for some of the other areas where Americans are not exactly looked upon with favor.
Well, music is an international language, of course, and
yep.
That's the magnificence of it. And, you know, the world stops when you play notes and you look at each other. You don't have to speak the language. And, of course, one being a musician, one does realize that. I wondered if you think that things can change through music
in terms of
international relations.
Not directly. I mean, even in Pyongyang, we were there. Really, because the North Korean government, some faction in the government, felt that a door had to be opened, and what better door to open mm-hmm. than one on absolutely neutral territory, such as classical music, because I think they were quite aware of the fact that their leader is not well, mm-hmm. and that the time would be coming soon.
When,
exactly. So And they invited 70 members of the press from all over the world, as you may know, from CNN to whatever. And, you know, we played the Star Spangled Banner first thing at the beginning of a concert for the assembled officials of the North Korean government. These, Korean officials were standing at attention listening to our national anthem, which had never, ever been played in North Korea. And when they sat down, they cheered.
That's wonderful.
That's amazing.
Absolutely.
And then at the end of the concert, the Arirang, which is a folk tune loved in both Koreas, everybody was in tears and they were very touched that we would want to play their most favorite tune. And we played it. And it was just fraternization with a capital F. And the point was made. And mind you, the North Koreans allowed it, this to happen. They wanted it to happen.
Amazing. That's wonderful.
So, I mean, it was they who invited us. It was they who had the press there. It was they who allowed all of us to be seen on television. And there was no control of who was filmed when. So obviously, it was a statement in itself, right?
It was, and again, the music you were playing, Western music on the concert, was did that make any difference in terms of understanding? I mean, we're talking about absorbing.
Well, we played the New World Symphony because I wanted to point out that we do have ethnic Americans, the Indians. Mm-hmm. And a great tune was taken from some of their musical heritage and used by a Czech mm-hmm. composer to identify the music that he situated in the Western Hemisphere. And in short, that our country has a rich and varied ethnic mix, that we're very proud of it. And it's recognized by folks abroad. And then we did The American in Paris, mm-hmm. A story about a mm-hmm. young person going abroad mm-hmm. and with an open mind and wanting to learn something in a culture that had grown so rich in every area. And that's when I said that someday, in introducing the piece, some composer might come along and write a piece, Americans in Pyongyang, which...
got a big hand, probably.
Yeah, well, it's a quote that appeared on the first page of every newspaper about the world. Over 100 newspapers quoted me on the first page. I couldn't believe it, and it's the last thing I had in mind.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to say. You actually, you know, you verbalized it. You know, it was just something that somebody had to say, and at least to show that that perhaps there was hope for understanding. You are a humanitarian. I mean, you've certainly demonstrated that in many of the things that you have done in terms of raising money and being active in certain organizations. And did you ever consider being an ambassador of sorts?
Well, in fact, I was for a period an ambassador of goodwill, so-called ambassador of goodwill for the United Nations. And I would, you know, make speeches and give concerts and whatever for a couple of years. Because I had done a lot of work for UNICEF and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and UNESCO and so forth. No, it's my work, my contribution is very modest and it's been very private. But I have given over 35 of such concerts and organized also some major fundraising events, one of which provided 150,000 inoculations for the street children of Brazil.
Yes.
Against malaria and yellow fever and what do they have? Something called, dengue fever, right?
Yes. So, but of course, this is all part of a lot of what you've done is also connected, of course, to music, and you've used that as a vehicle for fundraising as well. So you really have to, I guess, figure out how you're going to have some free time, because according to what you've told me, you have a very, very busy life, a very productive one, and it is wonderful. I mean, certainly, I don't want to say at your age, but you are just getting into your stride, I guess, and you will be going back to conduct again, orchestras that you love, and I suppose doing your composing. When can we look forward to 1984?
Well, I would really like it to be done in an American theater. After all, we've done it in Covent Garden, we've done it in La Scala. We're going to do it in 18 months' time in Paris and in Warsaw. And you know, so I'm awaiting an American house which will have the courage to put it forth, because our message is fairly clear. What we're saying is that the United States is certainly not exempt from this possibility, because the staging definitely hints at a problem also growing in our country. It's not just England or whatever. And I think some folks are a bit leery of presenting that message so clearly.
Which is, folks,
it may be happening right here at home. So sit up and take notice and stop it before it happens.
A good note to end on. Maestro, thank you so much. As I say, we could probably speak for hours with you, but a delight to hear your thoughts. I did see the part of the Tchaikovsky broadcast that you did on television, PBS.
Oh, yeah.
And it was absolutely fabulous, I must say. Very wonderful, wonderful performance. So you're used to hearing that. But again, a joy and an honor to speak with you, and the very, very best.
Thank you, Joe.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For a second listen to selected crossover interviews, visit www.wrti.org. Crossover was produced by Jill Pasternak in the studios of WRTI Philadelphia for the WRTI Radio Network. This is Joe Hattie, Crossover's technical producer. Crossover is syndicated nationally by Global Media Group Incorporated. Thanks for listening.